Hello, this is Terrence McNally. In these unsettling times, I looked back into the archives for two conversations about the meaning of life. First, you'll hear my 2009 conversation with physicist Fritjof Capra about the ideas in one of my favorite books of all time, The Turning Point. Written in 1981, it looked at many domains of human activity, work, economy, healthcare, politics, energy, agriculture, and made clear that we need to move toward a systems view of reality in all of them, one that sees everything as dynamic and interdependent. And true to those themes, in the second half, you'll hear my 2008 conversation with MacArthur Award-winning biologist Stuart Kaufman about the provocative ideas in his book, Reinventing the Sacred, in which he offers an inspiring image of God as the ceaseless creativity of the universe and of life itself. Hello, I'm Terry McNally, and welcome to KPFK and Free Forum. I'm going to read a rather long quote to lead into today's conversation, so bear with me, if you will. Here's the quote. I have come to believe that today, our society as a whole finds itself in a crisis. We can read about its numerous manifestations every day in the newspaper. We have high inflation and unemployment. We have an energy crisis, a crisis in healthcare, pollution and other environmental disasters, a rising wave of violence and crime, and so on. The basic thesis of the book he was writing is that these are all different facets of one and the same crisis, and that this crisis is essentially a crisis of perception. It derives from the fact that we are trying to apply the concepts of an outdated worldview, the mechanistic worldview of Cartesian, Newtonian science, to a reality that can no longer be understood in terms of these concepts. We live today in a globally interconnected world in which biological, psychological, social, and environmental phenomena are all interdependent. To describe this world appropriately, we need an ecological perspective, which the Cartesian worldview does not offer. What we need then is a new paradigm, a new vision of reality, a fundamental change in our thoughts, perceptions, and values. Now, any of you who listen to the show on a regular basis know I agree with that quote. Now, first of all, those are the words of today's guest, Fritjof Capra. But the amazing thing is that they were written in 1981 in the preface to his book, The Turning Point. The Turning Point, I believe, is a remarkable book. I've read it more than once, and I've given it as a present several times. And we'll talk today about the power of worldviews and why so little has changed in 27 years. Fritjof Capra has a new book out, The Science of Leonardo, and we'll talk about that as well. He says that most authors who have discussed the science of Leonardo da Vinci, the great master painter and genius of the Renaissance, have examined it through a Newtonian lens. And according to him, this has prevented them from understanding its essential nature, which he believes is radically different from the mechanistic science of those other giants, Galileo, Descartes, and Newton. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Fritjof Capra is a founding director of the Center for Ecoliteracy in Berkeley, California, which promotes ecology and systems thinking in primary and secondary education. He's on the faculty of Schumacher College, an international center for ecological studies in England, and he's the author of several bestsellers, including The Tao of Physics and The Turning Point. He also co-authored Green Politics and co-edited Steering Business Towards Sustainability. And his most recent book is the one that's just out, The Science of Leonardo. Welcome, Fritjof Capra, to KPFK and Free
Hello,
Forum.
Terry. Yeah, yes. Thank you for having me on your show. As you know, I live in Berkeley, and I've been on KPFA numerous times, but I've never been down here in KPFK, and I'm very happy to finally do an interview here.
Another turning point.
Right.
No, it's great to have you. As I think I said before we went on air, I've obviously, that book came out in 81, and as I said, I've read it more than once and actually have given. It's a rather thick book, but I've given it to people and said, here, this says
thank
a lot
you.
Of what needs to be said, and have followed your thinking over the years. So it's really my pleasure as well when I saw you were going to be in town. And you know, grab the chance to have you on. So one thing, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work when we start off. So let me ask you, how did a mild-mannered physicist become the author of books about worldviews and paradigm change?
Well, it all began with my interest in philosophy. My father was a lawyer, but very well read and very interested in philosophy. And at home, we had a large library of philosophers. My mother was a poet, and both my parents were very interested in art and, you know, dragged my brother and me through all the museums in Italy when we were around 10 or 12. So when I became a scientist and studied physics in Vienna, immediately I was interested in the philosophy of science, and I was very influenced by a book by Werner Heisenberg, one of the founders of atomic physics, quantum physics. The book is called Physics and Philosophy, and it's now a classic. And Heisenberg describes in it how those physicists struggled with a new worldview that was emerging in physics, with experiments that were totally mysterious at first and led them into radically new concepts. And that book stayed with me through my studies. And then came the 60s. I got interested in Eastern philosophy. George Harrison went to India, brought back a sitar, you know, and all these things worked together. And so I also became interested in the social movements in the 60s. I was in Paris in May 68. I was in Berkeley shortly after that. And all that eventually, you know, is reflected in my books. But first I explored the sort of expansion of consciousness into the spiritual, the religious, the mystical, and that's the Tao of physics. And then I explored the expansion of consciousness into the social realm, the social, questioning authority in many, many fields, you know, the kind of work that is now institutionalized here at KPFK.
Exactly.
But which was radical and you know, in living rooms and kitchens and grassroots movements in the 60s. And so in the turning point, I made this diagnosis, which you read, which I think, for better or worse, is still very valid, you know, in a sense, unfortunately. Now, the new paradigm, especially in science, but also in society, has progressed enormously. And I wrote a couple of books in between The Web of Life and The Hidden Connections, in which I really outline the systems view of life that is now rather complete, with a biological dimension, a cognitive dimension in the whole field of cognitive science, and a social dimension.
Let me cut you off for one second there, Fritjof Capra. When you said that in these intervening years, as you present in those later books, and they're The Web of Life and The Hidden Connections, right?
Right.
And I've also read both of them. You say the systems view of life has now been more rounded out and filled out.
And formalized,
through actual discoveries and work, or just better articulation?
Well, both, but a lot of discoveries. A key development came in the late 70s and early 80s with complexity theory, which is technically known as nonlinear dynamics. Now we have a mathematical language to describe nonlinear systems. Now, you may ask, what are nonlinear systems? Basically, everything you're interested in. You know, living organisms are non-living systems. The economy is a non-living system. Society,
community. Wait, you said non-living. You meant non-linear.
Non-linear, sorry.
Right.
The economy is a non-linear, and they're all living systems, right?
Exactly.
And that's why they are non-linear. And this connection between life and non-linearity, mathematically, if you want to describe it mathematically, was the big breakthrough around 1980.
So in other words, a couple of things I want to respond to that. One is that when you wrote the book, The Tao of Physics, and the book, The Turning Point, and you mentioned that you worked on The Turning Point for 6 years, so a lot of time you're working on that. This field hasn't really fleshed itself out yet. You're writing about something which calls for complexity theory before complexity theory has been articulated.
And I sort of cobbled together a chapter which I called The Systems View of Life. I sort of took things from all parts, but it's not a coherent theory. Now, 20 years later, I could write The Hidden Connections, where this synthesis that I'm now proposing is much more coherent and much more founded on actual science.
Okay, very good. The other thing I was going to say is, let's go to this question, and it's one of the big questions that I've been asking for many years, which is, I will state to people, preface, reality is not dead, mechanical, or separate. But reality is alive, evolving, and composed of interdependent systems.
Absolutely.
And I, when I've had Kenny Ausubel of the Bioneers, I say that's basically the premise of the Bioneers conferences,
right,
isn't it?
Right.
So I believe that such a worldview has been shared by indigenous peoples for millennia. It's been revealed by science since early in the 20th century. And now, not in its fullness, as you just pointed out. It's obvious to me every time you walk outside the door, look at the sky, look into the eyes of a living being. How do we explain the hypnotic hold of the mechanical worldview on people in power, let's say, or on the prevailing culture?
Well, I would guess it is through the connection between science and technology, because the mechanistic Newtonian science was the theoretical background of the Industrial Revolution, and it allowed people to design wonderful machines, from the steam engine on to, you know, the automobile. And, you know, most of the machines we're using now, today, actually require quantum theory to explain the physics that underlies.
I understand. And, in other words, driving a modern car, you're driving a computer on wheels, basically.
That's right, yeah. Driving a Prius, by the way, which is a great car.
Which we both drive, I assume. Yeah. Definitely, that one is a computer. You can't get that fixed elsewhere. Yeah. So what you're saying is that most of the machines that were the industrial age, and am I correct, most of the social systems that were the industrial age were based on that mechanical model.
That's right. You see, Newton's mechanics was the sort of model for everything, for all the sciences, and for many things where it's inappropriate, like medicine, for instance, or, you know, social science, economics, management. You know, a company is not a machine, and a community is not a machine. The human body is not a machine. But that was assumed, and people went quite far with it.
With God as the great clockmaker in
That's
the sky, right?
Right?
Let
That's
me tell people, by the way, you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Fritjof Capra. He's the author of many books, including the bestsellers The Tao of Physics and The Turning Point, and his newest, which we will talk about a little later in the program, is The Science of Leonardo. And you can learn more about his work and The Science of Leonardo at fritjofcapra.net, and that's FRITJOF Capra. One word. So when I asked, how do you explain the hypnotic hold, in other words, that people still want to function that way? I think if one looks at even American politics, American foreign policy under Bush, there's a lot of hierarchy and mechanist.
Yes, and linear thinking. You know, in Newtonian science, in the mechanistic paradigm, if you want to explain something, and Descartes actually was the founder of this strategy, if you want to explain something, you reduce it to the smallest components, and you try with the mechanisms that interconnect them to explain the whole. You don't make connections to other wholes. Now, let's take ecology or biology as a whole as an example. If you go out in the forest and see a bird with red feathers, and you want to explain this scientifically, you don't decompose the feathers. That doesn't, you know, you can look at the pigments, and that's one reason why they are red. But, you know, why did nature come up with red feathers? You have to relate the bird to its environment, to its habitat, to its history. That's ecological thinking, and it's systemic thinking. You have to connect the dots, as we say in a popular parlance. And this is a singular lack in our politicians, not just Bush, but, you know, all our political, or most of our political and corporate leaders, do not know how to connect the dots. So they go to Iraq to fight a war that bleeds the country, to get oil that we don't even need, because we have other means of energy now. If we had spent a fraction of that money developing conservation,
I believe it's up to
alternative
two,
sources.
I believe it's up to $2 or $3 billion a week right now.
Yeah.
And had we spent, as you say, a fraction of what we spent in Iraq developing renewable energy, we'd have done a service to the whole world.
Yes, and we would have prevented this rise of global warming, of global climate change, because of, you know, the greenhouse gases.
And you can
so
bet
on.
Oil wouldn't be costing $100 a barrel, if suddenly it had competition.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or you know, if we fed the children in our schools organically grown food, we wouldn't have the crisis of obesity, we wouldn't poison the farm workers. And again, the organically grown food in an organic soil needs a lot of carbon, because carbon is the chemical backbone of life. And where do these worms and bacteria take the carbon from? Well, from the air. They draw it down. Therefore, a carbon sink, again, you know, fighting global climate change through organic food in our schools. Well, that's connecting the dots. That's systemic thinking.
That's right. That's reality is alive and interdependent. By the way, I've had Ann Cooper on. Are you familiar with her? She runs the nutrition program in the Berkeley School District,
yes,
which now
is
teaching, is not only providing kids organic food, but teaching them about...
That's right. And at the Center for Ecoliteracy, we are very much involved in this
Yeah,
this
I wanted
program.
To ask you about that. And so since you just brought it up, I will. What was it when it started? And what do you feel you've accomplished over the years? Because you've been there a long time.
Yeah, over 10 years, about 12 years. Well, its mission is to promote ecological thinking, the science of ecology and systemic thinking in schools.
And let me say to people, if you've been following this conversation, when he says ecology, he doesn't mean something about the environment. Ecology is about the interweaving of all of life.
Yes, and it includes, of course, the environment. Yeah. So we take kids out into gardens, into school gardens, and have them experience ecology with the hands in the earth, the change of the season, the cycle of growth and decay of plants. They cook meals in schools. They go out and visit farms. They go to farmers' markets. So it's a whole program like this, which has grown tremendously, and it's always linked to curriculum. So what they learn in the classroom refers to what they learn in the garden, and vice versa.
And if people want to learn more about that, that's...
There's a link on my website to the Center for Ecoliteracy, and the website there is ecoliteracy.org.
Okay, ecoliteracy, one word, .org. Is some of that work available beyond Berkeley? Have you spread it to school systems around the country?
Yes, because we are now teaching seminars, and people come from all over the country, and they do things in other schools. They actually come from all over the world. With the internet now, with our website, which is very extensive, we announce our seminars, and we get participants from Brazil, from Norway, from Australia. It's absolutely fantastic.
That's very exciting. Yeah. Let me ask a couple of other questions. Let me mention one other thing. We've talked about it generally. The thing that most struck me about the turning point, besides the worldview, was that you, as you sort of briefly did just there, there's a section in there where you look at how that old worldview sort of hinders us in various arenas and how a new worldview could help us.
Right.
And you look at health and medicine. You look at agriculture. You look at business and economics. You look at energy and environment. Two questions. One, first, could you just like maybe speak about agriculture, okay, just for a bit? Second, have you thought of updating that book? Because it seems to me that is the reason that I've given it as a gift is I say, here's how to look at the big picture.
Well, in a sense, The Hidden Connections, which was published in 2002, is the 21st century version of the turning point. You see, at the turning point, as you said, I looked at biology, I looked at medicine, I looked at economics, but in The Hidden Connections, I look at life.
Ah, okay.
Because that's what they have in common. And I integrate the biological dimensions of life with the cognitive dimensions and the social dimensions. And I again look at all these sciences, but from an integrative point of view. Now, the historical section is still very valid in the turning point. And there, my big new discovery is that this systemic thinking, this relating everything to life, this seeing the earth as alive, was really founded by Leonardo da Vinci. That's why he's so important.
Okay.
It's not only fascinating to study him as a Renaissance genius, but he's tremendously relevant for our time.
Okay, now that's okay. We'll use that segue. Let me tell people that you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming, podcasting on the web at kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally. I'm speaking with Fritjof Capra. He's a best-selling author of several books, starting with The Tao of Physics, and his newest is The Science of Leonardo. Okay, so you say the discovery you made, and I'm going to ask you two questions again.
Right.
How did you happen to make that discovery? What led you back to look at Leonardo's science, and then what did it tell you?
Well, I had been fascinated by Leonardo since the 1970s when I wrote The Tao of Physics. I came across a statement that he wrote where he defines his empirical method, that he will observe nature and then draw conclusions and use reasoning to see why nature acts in a certain way. That's what we now call the scientific method. He also used mathematics. He also used theoretical models. And ever since that time, I thought he should really be interpreted from the point of view of our modern science of life, our complexity theory. And it took me 20, 30 years to get around to doing
right.
it.
Right. I think you even say that you have a quote from him early in the Tao of Physics, right?
No, it was in, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And that's now the epitaph of the new book. Now what was the second part of
the question?
The second question
is, so what? How far ahead of his time was he in terms of his use of, if not his definition of, the scientific method?
Well, Leonardo lived 100 years before Galileo, and he single-handedly created this empirical approach that we now call the scientific method.
What were people doing prior to that?
Well, knowledge was transmitted from the Greek philosophers. Science did not exist, not even the word science in our sense. It was called natural philosophy. And those were speculations that were transmitted from philosopher to philosopher, were never checked empirically, and then in the Middle Ages were fused with Christian doctrine and used as the official creed. And any questioning of Aristotle's thought was heretical. You see,
what you're saying, in case people didn't follow that, is that the church, which was the power broker on how people thought in the Western world,
right,
went back to the Greeks, merged it with their Christian or religious teaching,
right,
and said, this is reality.
Yes, absolutely.
And in other words, questioning Aristotle was the same as questioning Jesus.
Yes, yes. And of course, that's what where Galileo came to suffer. And 100 years earlier, Leonardo kept his findings secret.
For that reason?
For other reasons too, but also largely for that reason. And unfortunately, his voluminous notebooks, 13,000 pages when he died, were lost and hidden for centuries and were not really analyzed until the 19th century. This is why Leonardo had no direct influence on science.
So what you're saying is he preceded it, but didn't necessarily
Didn't inform it. But there's a sort of a virtual lineage from Leonardo da Vinci to Johann Wolfgang von Goethe in Germany, the poet and scientist, to Gregory Bateson, the cyberneticist and systems theorist, to Prigogine, Maturana, Varela, all the people that I have written about, Lynn Margulis, the Gaia hypothesis, Gaia theory. All this is a lineage of which Leonardo stands at the beginning.
Now that's an interesting phenomenon, and let me ask you what you say about that. The fact that he preceded it, in his one self, in his one mind, in his one approach, could see it and practice it, and yet because it wasn't looked at, so what happens when something like, in other words, I'm saying there's the seed, but the seed did not lead to this.
His discoveries were rediscovered independently some 200 years later, some 300 years later, some even only in the 20th century. His anatomy of the heart contains details that people are now verifying with computer models. I mean, absolutely incredible.
You said that one of the keystones, and by the way, I'm speaking with Fritjof Capra about his new book, The Science of Leonardo. Fritjof is the author over the years of The Tao of Physics and The Turning Point and so on. His method, you said, was empirical.
Yes.
And so how does he...
Was it
cadavers or was it imagination?
No. It was experiments, observations in botany, in geology, in the science that is now called fluid dynamics or hydrodynamics, which he was the first to really create. In many, many fields, it was empirical and it was systematic scientific thinking. But the big thing that other authors have not realized before is that he must be compared to Galileo in terms of method, but not in terms of content, because Leonardo's science was not mechanistic. It was a science of life. It was a science of systemic thought, a science of living forms that were always transforming themselves, always in development, very much like our systems and complexity theories today.
And were there others through the years who saw things that way, or was he...
Yes, 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 there were others. There was a whole movement called Romantic Biology in Germany, then it moved to England, and, a whole series of biologists who focused on organic forms, on the nature of biological form. That influenced Darwin in his early work. So all this, but again, Leonardo was not a direct influence,
right,
but
right.
It was rediscovered. And then the whole field of systems theory, cybernetics, and modern studies of what is now called morphology, a term actually created in the 18th century by Goethe, the study of biological form. All these virtually are sort of in the lineage that starts with Leonardo.
Now, when he is seeing things that way, and then later people are seeing things that way, we've spoken about it a little earlier in the conversation, but the fact that the Newtonian understanding, the mechanical understanding, had such power in the world.
Yes.
In other words, you could build a machine
yes.
and move a mountain.
Yes.
That gave it a power in the mind, didn't
yes,
it?
Yes, but you see, there is where Leonardo is really unique. There have been other geniuses in history of humankind, but this is where Leonardo is unique because, as is well known and widely known, he was a mechanical genius. He was a
That's
genius
right.
inventor. He's known for his machines, right?
That's right,
much
more than his science.
Than his science. And so this is a very subtle thought. He was a mechanical genius, but his worldview was not mechanistic. And in fact, very beautifully, he saw mechanics as a very noble science because, he says, nature has given mechanical instruments to animals because otherwise they couldn't move. And I'm going to study those mechanical instruments, he says. And so he studies mechanics for years and years in order to understand the movement of living bodies. So mechanics is subservient as a science to the life sciences, rather than saying living organisms are machines and therefore mechanics is at the top. It was just the opposite.
So he was a true synthesizer and a true,
yes.
had an integral
Absolutely.
View, which
Absolutely.
Which we have now waited hundreds of years
yes.
to
yes.
gain some power
and,
again.
And in addition, his science was infused with the very deep ethics, a love of nature, a special compassion for animals. He always took nature as his mentor and model in his designs. So he was an eco-designer, if you wish. And this is, again, why he's so relevant for our time.
Right. You wrote a book with Stendhal Rast, and we've only got about a minute. You wrote a book with Stendhal Rast called Belonging in the Universe?
Yes.
In which you reconcile modern religion and modern science, about which this great argument
yeah.
going on today. It sounds like Leonardo himself kind of embodied that.
Yes, yes, absolutely. In his deep ecological awareness and his great reverence for life. That comes through his whole science.
Why would you recommend someone read this book?
Well, if you're interested in the history of Western thought, if you're interested in the Renaissance, if you're interested in the synthesis of art and science, and if you're interested in one of the greatest minds that ever lived, then read the book.
And also, it seems to me, one other thing is that you can see someone who saw what is so before the cloud of that mechanical worldview
yes.
covered
yes.
it. And maybe for even us, it's a way
Absolutely.
To see the whole
yes.
in a way we haven't before.
Yes.
So again, the book is The Science of Leonardo. The earlier books, which I highly recommend as well, include The Tao of Physics, The Turning Point, and The Web of Life. The website is fritjofkapra.net. That's FRITJOF. Capra.net. Thank you, Fritjof Capra, and keep
Thank
up
you.
The good work.
It was a pleasure. Thanks
it really
so much,
was.
Terry.
Thanks a lot. Hello, this is Terrence McNally. In the second half, you'll hear my 2008 conversation with MacArthur Award-winning biologist Stuart Kaufman about the provocative ideas in his book Reinventing the Sacred, in which he suggests an inspiring image of God as the ceaseless creativity of the universe and of life itself. Hello and welcome to Free Forum. I'm Terry McNally. I wrote something in January 2005, reflecting on the 2004 election, in which I felt that the deciding factor may well have been the significant percentage of Bush voters who were misinformed about whether or not we'd found WMD in Iraq or Saddam had been involved with Al-Qaeda or 9/11. I drew a bigger lesson from this triumph of ignorance. This is what I wrote. Quote, for a system or an organism to thrive and evolve, intelligence should offer guidance and direction. With unprecedented technological power, humanity now more than ever needs intelligent direction. Yet intelligence is not in the driver's seat, at least not in America, still the world's most powerful entity. It is underperforming and under siege. Losing out to ignorance, greed, ideology, cleverness is not an option. The stakes are too high, whether in war, terror, or environmental catastrophe. Now, it strikes me that intelligence has been defined by so many as just cognitive, brainiac intelligence, and that we need to create a more robust definition that includes emotional, physical, spiritual, intuitive intelligence, so that intelligence can connect with and engage the greater society. So then I started seeking out guests with something to say about these and related issues, such as the roles of religion and science in society. I even came up with a book title for a collection of such interviews, Wrestling with Religion and Reality. In preparing to interview today's guest, Stuart Kaufman, I got truly excited that in his thinking and in his new book, Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion, he has pulled together some very big ideas that go a long way to making sense of the largest dilemmas we face, and that he envisions a way forward that might restore our chances for success. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Stuart Kaufman is the director of the Institute for Biocomplexity and Informatics at the University of Calgary. He's a MacArthur Fellow and an external professor at the Santa Fe Institute. He's the author of The Origins of Order, At Home in the Universe, The Search for Laws of Self-Organization, Investigations, and his newest, Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. Welcome, Stuart Kaufman, to KPFK and Free Forum.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. So, you were originally a medical doctor. Your primary work has been as a theoretical biologist studying the origin of life, molecular organization. You've also applied the science of complexity to business management. And then in your newest book, you take on the biggest questions of religion and science. Could you briefly talk about your path to the work that you're doing today?
Well, yes, I can. I came into science profoundly interested in how a fertilized egg grows into an adult. And the problem is called cell differentiation and how 30,000 genes turn one another on and off to make the different cell types in your body. So I've worked on that. I've worked on the origin of life. I hold founding patents in what is now called combinatorial chemistry. I've started 4 companies. I lived in one of them. And I've had fun being a scientist. So this has led me to investigations, which in turn led to reinventing the sacred. And maybe you have to get antique or at least older. I'm now 68 and 2/3 plus or minus a little bit. So this is the over 65 set. And part of what's driving me, Terry, is the following set of things. A global civilization of some form is emerging. We don't know whether it'll be homogeneous or forever heterogeneous, but it's driven by global commerce. It's driven by global communication. People, in response to it, are in part retreating into fundamentalisms that are often religious and often hostile. Meanwhile, we confront peak oil, that year when we will get the most oil out of the ground that we will get, which may be about now, with catastrophic possible consequences for our global economy, with global warming, water shortages, resource wars, death, hunger. And we profoundly lack a global ethic that we can share across the planet. We lack a shared sense of the sacred that we can share across the planet. And I think we've got to find it. And my book, Reinventing the Sacred, is my best shot at it.
Mm-hmm. And in the first lines of your book, I'm going to read. The title of this book, Reinventing the Sacred, states its aim. I will present a new view of a fully natural God and of the sacred based on a new emerging scientific worldview. And then you say, this new worldview reaches further than science itself and invites this new view of God, the sacred, and ourselves, ultimately including our science, art, ethics, politics, and spirituality. Ambitious. What is that new worldview, and what is the worldview it's replacing?
Can we start with the second?
Yes.
Okay. It's the view that it is replacing, with the cautionary note of a scientist that I may be wrong, okay?
Excellent.
All scientists are taught to say that, because otherwise you get in trouble. And I may be wrong, but I don't think I am. We'll see when we get to the crux spot, if we get there. So it really comes from Descartes, Galileo, Newton, Einstein, Schrodinger. Okay, and was best stated by a French mathematician, Simon-Pierre Laplace, in Napoleon's time, who said, if there were a superb intelligence, not meaning God, just a superb intelligence, that knew the positions and the velocities and the masses of all the particles in the universe, then using Newton's laws, that intelligence could compute the entire future and the entire past of the universe. The past, because Newton's laws are time reversible. Now, there are three aspects of this reductionistic worldview.
And let me just, you know, for some people probably hearing that, there were a lot of things in that. One of them was, it was the location and velocity of all the particles in the universe.
All the particles.
Okay.
All the particles. Absolutely essential. Thanks, Terry. So there are three aspects to this reductionism. The first is that everything is deterministic. That is to say, if you start things the same way, the same things will happen. And that comes from Newton's laws, which are deterministic. Well, within a century, quantum mechanics called that into question with the famous Copenhagen interpretation and what's called the Born rule, where things are probabilistic, and Einstein was upset with God playing dice with the universe. The second, which is the broadest in our Western world view, is what I'm about to tell you. It is the view that everything that happens in the universe is describable by natural law. I think that's wrong. And that is the most startling thing I'm going to say. I think I'm correct. I think it requires examination. If I'm right, it changes huge tracts of our view of the world, because I'm going to wind up saying that part of what happens in the evolution of the biosphere, the economy, human culture, and maybe even the abiotic universe is not describable by law. Instead, there's an endless creativity.
And let me say it again to people to emphasize some of the nuances here. A lot of people, it seems to me, in fact, I've interviewed many of them over the years because it's something I'm looking at, will point out the first problem in that worldview, which is that the reductionist thing, that everything is that everything went according to Newton's laws. And then you say, well, what about quantum physics? What about relativity? And
right.
So that one's out there. But the second one
is absolutely new.
Is new.
It's absolutely new. It is the most radical thing I'm saying in a chapter called Breaking the Galilean Spell. I do confess that the title Breaking the Galilean Spell came to me while I was taking a bath. And I thought it was too good to ignore, so I used it.
And let me tell you, by the way, the voice that you hear is Stuart Kaufman. He's the director of the Institute for Biocomplexity and Informatics at University of Calgary. And his most recent book is what we're talking about, Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. I'm Terry McNally. This is KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. And if you want to learn more, in addition to the book, Resurrecting the Sacred, you could go to the Edge, to edge.org, edge.org, and then look for this article, put in this article, Breaking the Galileo Spell.
Galilean
spell. Okay, so Galileo and everyone since has basically said we can explain things through natural laws. Stuart Kaufman says not so.
Correct. And we can go straight to it, Terry, if you want to. And I will ask the question of the audience that's listening that I've asked of everybody. But it takes about 2 to 3 minutes to say this. Okay. So suppose we went to Mr. Darwin and said, Darwin, what's the function of the heart, say the human heart? Well, he would say it's to pump blood. And then we might say, but you know, it makes heart sounds. And he would say, yes, but that's not the function of the heart. The heart was selected to pump blood. And basically, he's right. Okay, so there's a whole discussion there to be had, because you see, when Darwin says the function of the heart's to pump blood, he discriminates between that which has been selected and that which hasn't. And the physicist can't do that. The physicist can talk about what is, but not a subset of the causal consequences of what is, namely pumping blood as opposed to making heart sounds. And that's part of the argument that biology is emergent with respect to physics.
Okay,
that's not the main point I want to make.
I know, but let me get into that one just for a second so people are with us. You said pumping blood, everyone thinks, okay, that's what the heart's for. Then you say heart sounds. When you select that, heart sounds, you just mean something else that the heart does, or something else that happens if it's a heart.
Correct.
But not the thing that we seem to focus on.
Exactly so.
Okay.
Another example is that when your heart pumps blood, water in your pericardial sac that holds the heart wiggles. Well, that isn't the function of the heart either.
It's not about wiggling.
Okay. Jiggling would be more scientific. So here was Darwin's next wonderful idea. He said, you know what? I bet there are properties of, say, organs, like hearts, of no use whatsoever in the current environment, like jiggling water in the pericardial sac or making heart sounds, that might turn out to be useful in some quite different selective environment. So that's called now a Darwinian pre-adaptation, and famous Stephen Jay Gould call them exaptations, but it's the same idea.
There's pre-adaptation, something that existed and was an adaptation to an environment that organism or organ wasn't in at the time.
That's correct. And there is no notion in the phrase pre-adaptation of a designer, creator, God, intelligent design, or anything. It's just there. Okay. Now, I'm going to give a couple of examples. The first I'm going to talk about is something called a swim bladder. Some fish have an organ called a swim bladder. It's partially filled with air, partially filled with water. The amount of water in the swim bladder adjusts neutral buoyancy in the water column and helps keeps the fish turned upright, okay? Here's how paleontologists believe that the swim bladder arose. So there are fish that have lungs. They're called lungfish. The thought is that water got into the lungs of the lungfish. Now you have a sac with air and water in it. It's on its way to becoming a swim bladder, okay? So that's a Darwinian pre-adaptation. Now I'm going to ask some essential questions about it. First, did a new function come to exist in the biosphere, adjusting neutral buoyancy in the water column? Well, I think we'd both agree that the answer is obviously yes. Second, did it have an effect on the evolution of the biosphere? Sure, new species, new proteins, new molecules. So it had causal consequences. Now is my big question. I'm going to ask you, Terry.
Okay.
Ready? Do you think, honestly, that you could say ahead of time all possible Darwinian pre-adaptations for all organisms or, say, just for human beings?
No. In other words, you're saying, could I sit here now and tell you everything that is a descriptor or a function or something within us that we aren't using yet? Is that what you're saying?
That might turn out.
No, of course not, because what that stuff is difficult to see because of where we stand and where I look at this moment.
That's exactly right.
Now, so you're saying that the fact that we can't predict all of those is important?
It's good. Watch what happens. Now, it turns out that I've talked by now to thousands of people. We all say the same thing. We all say, nope. We cannot say ahead of time what Darwinian pre-adaptations are going to be in the biosphere, and it'll turn out in the economy and in human culture, too. So we'll get there in a moment. Now, watch what happens. First of all, could we do what Newton told us to do? So here's what Newton told us to do about a billiard table. He said, look, here's a billiard table. It's got billiard balls on it. Name the variables, well, or the billiard balls, and their positions and velocities and masses. Now name the laws among these variables. I just happened to write them down. Here's my three laws of motion. Now look at the boundary conditions, the edges of the billiard table. Now compute. Just go ahead. I invented the calculus. Compute what's going to happen. And lo and behold, you can compute what's going to happen. So that's Newton. Now let's ask, can we do that for the biosphere? Can we write down the variables such that we can talk about the evolution of the biosphere from before until after swim bladders come into existence?
Right. In other words, what both Newton and Laplace
said
which was that if you know those mathematical pieces of information about the particles in the universe, you should be able to predict whatever's going to ever happen in the biosphere. And as you say, not just the biosphere, in human culture.
And
then
economy.
You actually focus on human economy, which I
right.
think to some people will be one of the more interesting things. You pick up a book that seems to be a scientist talking about science and religion. Okay, that's a lot already. But you actually do put the human economy as
a critical
example. A world kind of worth studying that to you is another one of these exceptions to those predictive rules of these natural laws.
It is, absolutely. And can we get there in a sec?
Yeah.
So let's just sort of stay where we are
yeah.
for a moment. So can we write down the Newtonian trick and do it for the biosphere? And the answer is no, because we do not know ahead of time the variables that are going to come into existence. We don't know the billiard balls. We don't know swim bladders, lungs, livers, noses, your middle ear bones, which evolved from three adjacent bones in an early fish. We don't know, so we can't do it. So we can't do what Newton said. By the way, let me go back to part of why you said no, and we all do. One of them is, how would we say ahead of time what all selective environments are?
Right.
It seems impossible.
Yeah.
The second thing is, let's come back to the jaw bones. Three adjacent jaw bones in an early fish became three adjacent bones in your middle ear, the incus malleus and stapes that help you hear. Had one of those bones been in the skull, one in the spine and one in the jaw, would we have gotten the same thing in the middle ear? Almost certainly not. That means the spatial relations among those jaw bones mattered. So let's use the physicist's phrase, relational degrees of freedom. Do we have any way whatsoever to specify ahead of time the relationships among things within or between organisms that might turn out to be pre-adaptations in environments that we can't state? And the answer seems to be obviously no.
I'm going to say we've got about 9 minutes more. And so I want us to move a little bit more into the implications of this rather than laying out the whole thing. If I had an hour
or
two,
the whole thing.
We'd do the whole thing.
But look, Terry, let me get one sentence beyond.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Most people think a natural law is a compact description of the regularities of a process, like Newton's laws, or like Einstein's laws, or like Schrodinger's equation from quantum mechanics. Do you think we could have a law, a natural law, for the emergence of swim bladders? Well, the answer seems to be obviously no. We can't even pre-state the possibility. How could we have a law? Okay? That means something stunning. It means, if this is right, that contrary to what Laplace thought, Descartes thought, Galileo thought, Newton thought, and Einstein thought, what happens in the unfolding of the universe, at least the biosphere, maybe the whole universe, is partially beyond natural law. And it's from that the wellsprings flow, because it means a lot.
Well, let me just say one of the things that I take it to mean, and tell me if I'm right, because I was, you know, explaining to someone earlier today, I'm going to go interview this guy, and this is kind of what he says, and I tried to, is that once life emerges, once there's something you call agency,
yep,
and agency has something to do with will, it has something to do with choice, and once that emerges, then all that stuff that applied to pool balls, billiard balls, doesn't apply anymore. And one of the key things you say is the thing we were just talking about. You cannot predict all of that. And,
that's right.
And the fact that there is agency, that there is choice, that there is and choice, I don't mean to say conscious choice, right? In other words, life has an agency that still defies prediction.
That's right. We cannot predict how the biosphere is going to evolve. We just can't.
And why is that so critical? And what are the implications of that?
Well, the same thing's true in the economy. So I don't have time to tell you
right.
the story of the invention of the tractor, but it involves a similar...
Well, let me see if I can do it quickly again, because okay. I tried to figure it out. Basically, the tractor had an engine case, right?
Yep.
That was too heavy for the ways they thought of putting it together.
Well, they were trying to put it on a chassis that would hold it, and it kept breaking chassis.
Right.
And finally, one of the engineers said, you know what? The engine block is so big and rigid, we can use the engine block itself as the chassis and hang everything off the engine block. And that's how tractors are made.
Right.
That's a Darwinian pre-adaptation. It's a causal...
The rigidity and weight of the chassis, which looked like a problem, actually was an opportunity.
Of the engine block.
Right.
Right. And in fact, most inventions are used for purposes besides that for which they were invented. For example, when the computer was invented, nobody foresaw Facebook, right? I pick Facebook because it's the height of Western civilization. So, what this means is that the same thing is true for the evolution of our economy and culture. It's not describable entirely by natural law. That means...
And one of the ways that you say, one of the key things there that I get from that is, how do you know something cannot be explained by natural law is if you cannot predict it from what you know right now.
Right. Okay. Now, let's look at consequence number one. The highest virtue, human virtue of the Enlightenment that we all love is reason. But what I just told you is we really don't know. In fact, I just talked to Jan Rivkin, who's in charge of teaching strategy at Harvard Business School. And he said, you know what? We have no methodology whatsoever. We just give them a lot of hard problems and hope they get good at it. And business people are precisely people who are trying to figure out what to do in a world when they don't know. That means that reason, our beloved reason, is an insufficient guide for living our lives. We need emotion. We need intuition. We need metaphor. We need story. We need whatever we can bring to bear that we've evolved over the last 3 billion years to manage to live our lives. I think, Terry, this means something enormous. It means that we have to re-understand our integrated humanity. We don't understand it. And that's why I say at the beginning of the book, this goes way beyond science. It involves art, politics, plumbing, the law, radio interviews,
and if I may, it goes to that thing that I said at the top, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
In other words, that's why when I read, you know, when I started reading your stuff, I got so excited, which is that if, as I've seen happen in American society, if intelligence is just rationality,
it's insufficient,
then it's easy to attack.
Right.
And what ends up happening is we then throw out the baby with the bathwater with people who sort of turn their back on rationality. What you're saying is that's because it isn't all that's going on. It isn't
right.
all that we have at our resource, with or without the words of a holy book or not.
That's right. So we have to re-understand and reintegrate our entire humanity. I truthfully believe we need a new enlightenment because, and then I want to get to God.
Very
but,
good.
But let me say this about the enlightenment or a new enlightenment. We have to understand if what we've said is correct, Terry, about partial lawlessness, then the view that we've had in the West is about reductionism and explaining everything is wrong. We have to understand what it is to be human in a world where in part we have laws, but in part we don't have it and we don't know. What does it mean to be fully human and make our way? So that's a huge topic, and it's going to take a long time to understand it. Now, if I may, let me turn to God. How many gods have we worshipped in the last 100,000 years? Lots.
Many, many.
At least seven. Okay. Have our ideas about our Abrahamic God changed in the last 4,500 years? Well, Yahweh was a tough God. He
right.
was a warrior, law-giving God. And
the New Testament, the God of love, the God of compassion and
mercy. The New Testament is a God of love. I think God is a symbol that humanity has invented. And I think it is our choice whether or not we wish to use that symbol in a new way and reinvent God. And here is what I think we should think about. In place of law, in the becoming of the biosphere and human civilization, and maybe the whole universe, there is an incredible and ceaseless creativity. Let's distinguish between the creator God and the creativity of that God. Do we need the creator God anymore? I say we don't. We need the creativity. And we've got the creativity. It's here in this boundless creativity. We are children of this creativity. I'm going to tell one personal story that I think brings it home. I was sitting in my house up in Canada, and there is a hillside and a river right next to us. The hillside is covered with spruce and fir. And I looked at the spruce and fir, and I said, you know, I could cut that down if I wanted to. But in my sense of God, that spruce and fir forest is God's work. How dare I? I'd better have a very good reason. Then I looked at the river, and I said, I could dam that river if I wanted to, but that's God's work. I'd better have a very good reason. You see, I think this view of God invites a sense of the sacred. The sacred becomes all of life and the planet.
Including us. Including the us. You that sits there and considers
right.
cutting down that forest or damming that
become
river.
Part of the sacred.
You, in your creative response to the question you yourself raised, then your perception, and
that's
then
right.
your feeling, and then your resonance, and then your emotion, and then all of those things that went into that moment, that is part of the creativity, and that is God.
That's right. In this view, we're not made in God's image. We too are God, but so is the worm, the butterfly, the tree, and the planet.
And that God is the endless, boundless, continuous creativity of existence, or of life.
Of existence and of the natural world. So then the hope is we can get from a sense of the sacred to a global ethic that can guide us in the face of peak oil, water resources being limited, global warming, a global civilization. We have to do it, Terry. We're killing one another.
That's right. Our creativity is what has created the problems that we face.
Exactly.
In other words, it was our creativity that discovered the value of oil. It was our creativity that
right.
created the internet. It was our creativity that found the value of hygiene and thus led to enormous populations. And it is our creativity that must get us out of this,
right.
and that's the role of God. I got to wrap it up. The book is Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. You can learn more by going to theedge.org, EDGE.org, and then looking for Stuart Kaufman, KAUFFMAN, or his particular essay, Breaking the Galilean Spell. Thank you, Stuart Kaufman. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to Code WAC, your podcast on America's broken healthcare system and how Medicare for All could help. I'm your host, Brenda Gazar. Today, we'll hear from a public health expert about the coronavirus pandemic and what forces may fuel America's reluctance to adopt a single-payer healthcare system. We have Dr. Tony Eitan here with us. He's a Senior Vice President for Healthy Communities at the California Endowment, a statewide health foundation. Welcome to Code WAC, Dr. Eitan. You've said that every developed country in the world has universal healthcare and paid sick leave, except the United States. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that there's a long and unfortunately ugly history in this country of the inability to essentially create the social solidarity that's needed to create universal policies. If the narrative basically says that undeserving people will get health care for free, or undeserving people will just take time off of work and get paid, then there isn't enough public will to get behind universal policies like universal health care or universal paid leave. And a lot of that has been driven by racism. It's overwhelming. overwhelmingly racism. I mean, you don't have to look very far in this country to see our history of apartheid, and it's overt racism. I mean, you see this throughout the history of legislative policymaking in this country. This is true in the New Deal. This has been true across a number of other policies. It used to be more overt. Now it's, you know, it's full of dog whistles and this notion of crack babies and welfare moms and makers versus takers. In a nutshell, is American racism has precluded America from having Medicare for all.
Get the full Code WAC story on progressivevoices.com and on the PV app. You can also listen to our episodes at www.heal-ca.org. This podcast is powered by Heal California, a nonprofit that uplifts the voices of those fighting for healthcare reform around the country. Until next time, stay healthy.
The Progressive Voices audience has grown to nearly a million regular listeners. Unfortunately, so have our operational costs. We feel it's important to protect the very limited commercial nature of the stream. So to keep up with these costs, we need your financial help. If you want to continue enjoying great shows like Randy Rhodes, Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, Leslie Marshall, and so many others on the free mobile Progressive Voices platform, please go to progressivevoices.com and press the donate button right now. Thank you.